So there's a saying, speak when you're angry and you'll make the best speech you'll ever regret. But when it comes to negotiation, emotions, anger, happiness, joy, fear, those things, no matter how much data, strategy, numbers, or rationality we think we bring to the table, those emotions always play a role and we ignore them to our peril. Dan Shapiro has new ways of thinking about how emotion and identity play into the negotiations of all kinds between romantic partners, political parties, even warring nations. And he shares those insights in the new book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable: How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Dan Shapiro is also the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It is wonderful to be here with you.
It's great to be here with you across the table, although this is more of a conversation rather than a negotiation.
That's right. We might need to change the room around side by side. Yes. Okay.
Well, I also just want to invite listeners into the conversation because I'm sure everyone out there has been in a negotiation, whether they knew it or not, where emotion played a role. And I'd love to hear your stories about how you handled it when emotion got in the way, or maybe did emotion help you in a negotiation at home, at work, in your neighborhood, at any time, and what questions you might have for Dan Shapiro on how to handle and recognize when emotions are interfering with our ability to negotiate. So call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send me a tweet at Radio Boston. Dan, I actually wanted to start with a story that you tell in the very, very beginning of the book about one of the personal reasons why you wanted to write about emotions and negotiations, because you've been around the world helping people with very complex negotiations, but there's something that you wrote about regarding a young woman which really stayed with you.
I was in the imploding Yugoslavia back in the early 1990s, teaching communication skills to a group of refugee children, ages literally 7 to 17. And there was this one very quiet student from a workshop. I call her Veronica in the book. It's an anonymous name, but to a real person. And at the end of our workshop, we're sitting at the cafe, and all of a sudden she opens up. And she tells the story of how, some 9 or so months earlier, she'd been with her boyfriend at their flat, in their apartment. And all of a sudden there's a knock on the door, and into the room storm these gentlemen with guns and knives in hand. Mm. They threaten her, they threaten her boyfriend, and literally right in front of her, she says, they hold her boyfriend's head and slit his throat. Mm. And you just, and this very quiet Veronica, who'd been sitting across from me, she opened up, you know, just incredibly so colorfully. And the moment she says that, whew, she draws back within. The next morning, we're leaving to go to Hungary by train. We get to the train station at 7 o'clock in the morning, and surprise, surprise, all 24 students from our workshop are there waiting for us, including Veronica. And she comes up to me with both this affectionate statement as well as almost I don't want to say a warning, but something she says to me, don't forget us. Don't be like all the others who come here, say they're going to help, and then walk away and forget us.
Yeah.
And I gave her my word.
And this book is then one of the ways in which you're telling her that you're not forgetting her. I mean, because I'm thinking about, you know, okay, former Yugoslavia, a perfect example of how conflict seems so rooted in history, religion, ethnicity, emotion. It's all mixed up together. Yeah. And in what seemed to be an intractable situation.
Yes.
And what sort of commonalities does something, you know, a catastrophe like that have with the more quotidian negotiations that you also talk about in the book?
Yeah. I mean, the book is in a sense a way to meet my word with her, but she also serves in my own heart as a symbol in terms of working with so many people who struggle with issues of identity and conflict. And I think in a sense, it's all of us. So for example, I've done some work with the New York Police Department's hostage negotiation team. One of their most brilliant officers one day came up to me and he said, Dan, you know what all your conflicts have in common? I said, well, I don't know. What do they all have in common? He said, you were there. And as silly and simple as that answer might sound, I found it profound because it's true. We often don't notice that the heart of why we are emotionally invested in our conflicts is the fact that our identity is somehow threatened or implicated in this conflict situation.
Okay, so tell me more about that. I mean, that leads me to wonder if every, not just conflict, but every, even just a regular negotiation has an element of emotion and identity in it.
Absolutely. I mean, why is it that driving here to Boston today for this interview with you, you know, someone cuts me off on the road. Why do you get so enraged over something so stupid as that? Well, maybe it's not so stupid if you look at it from the perspective of identity. I want to be treated as a person with dignity. My identity is someone who, you know, deserves that right. And all of a sudden, you car in front of me, you know, beside me, you cut me off. Maybe it's the trivial isn't so trivial when it comes to conflict much of the time.
Right. So it seems to me, though, I want to get down to sort of brass tacks in just a minute about how to recognize these moments and strategies around them. But it does seem to me that very frequently when people are negotiating, especially on their own behalf, that this idea of identity and emotion and how they're playing into the situation aren't even given any thought.
No, not at all. And I think the single, what I write about.
But they're really important drivers, though, as you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so the single deadliest mindset that we often get into in a conflict, in the book, I call it the tribes effect. And this is a mindset of me versus you, us versus them. You know, suddenly instead of it being the United States of America, it's the Republicans versus the Democrats or, you know, sub-parties negotiating. Suddenly instead of two lovely, you know, spouses working effectively together, the moment that mindset hits, it sinks in and it is very difficult to extract oneself from that mindset.
Mm. It happens almost instantaneously, I'd say.
It happens almost instantaneously. And more than that, it can stick for days or weeks or with Israelis and Palestinians, generations through narrative. Mm-hmm. And even worse than this, what we found through the research is that there tend to be all of these emotional forces that pull us toward that mindset, even when it's self-sabotaging.
Okay, so you write about, in the book, negotiating the non-negotiable. Interesting title, which I'm going to ask you about in a second. But you write about in the book something you call the five lures of the tribal mind. And they are vertigo, repetition compulsion, taboos, assault on the sacred, and identity politics. So let's start with vertigo. What, in this context, what is that and why is it so important to recognize?
So think about the most recent conflict. You don't have to share it on the air, you know, but think about the most recent conflict that you've gotten into.
Getting my five-year-old dressed to go to school in the morning.
This is a good one. Yes, okay, I have a four-year-old and we're in a very similar situation. Vertigo is when you get so emotionally consumed in that conflict situation that you can think of nothing other than the conflict and other than that evil perpetrator of the conflict, even that if that happens to be your cute little five-year-old or in my case, four-year-old. You know? This is vertigo. And vertigo, it's this warped sense of time and space. In the book, the way I write about it is it's as though if you and I are in the midst of a conflict, there's an emotional tornado spinning around us and all we can see is the feared future above us, which feels inevitable. Mm-hmm. And the ground beneath, which is becoming swelled and the ground is being pulled apart, that's the problematic history. Everything, you know, 4 years ago on a Tuesday, you did this to me and I'll talk about that right now because I hate your guts right now. That's vertigo.
So how do you prevent yourself from getting sucked into the vertigo maelstrom?
So simple way. Let me give it through example. So I was recently in the Middle East working with Israeli and Palestinian diplomats, sharing with them some of these new concepts, including vertigo. I get an email now just 3-4 weeks back from this one diplomat, and she says, I was there in an informal meeting between Israelis and Palestinians, and she said, we started talking about the politically sensitive issues. I saw that tornado of vertigo coming, and she said, I asked myself that question, and the most beautiful of questions, do you really want to go there? You know? Do you really want to go there? And she said, ultimately, I decided, no,
right.
I don't. And she said it was a much more effective, productive conversation. The emotion's still there, but she's not getting sucked into the spinning cycle of it.
It seems as if it requires a little gap, a conscious, mindful, even if I could say that, stepping back in a moment where it might often be very, very hard to do so.
Well, that's true. So if a couple knows that you're, you know, every Friday you're going to get into the argument about where to go for dinner that Friday night, don't wait until you get into the argument to figure out how you're going to deal with it. Recognize as you're driving home, you know, this evening, wait a minute, I might get into an argument with my spouse about this issue. Vertigo might come. Well, what can I say or do to try and preempt that vertigo from happening? Mm-hmm. So you can prepare for it to some degree. you know.
Well, we are speaking with Dan Shapiro. He is the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program, and his new book is Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. And Dan, we've actually got a couple of callers here who have some questions for you, so let's take them really quick if we can. Debbie is calling from Sudbury. You're on the air, Debbie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's your thought today?
Great. So I started a publication with my dad, and we're both very passionate. We have different talents, and we've come together to collaborate. And we've had these emotionally charged arguments that have almost disbanded us. And he said yesterday, you know, we have to look at this with a cold corporate eye, and I want to look at it with a warm collaborative eye. And, you know, I'm struggling with, you know, not changing our relationship and being able to stay in business with, in this case, my dad, but a family member. But we both get emotional. I yell, he doesn't. And, you know, we just can't seem to get beyond that. And obviously, you know, a lot of people have told me you don't ever work with family. I don't buy it. I think it can be done when there's enough talent and enough, you know, ability to get beyond the emotion. And I'd love some tips to help us kind of bridge that problem.
Right. Debbie, thank you so much for your call. Dan, your thoughts?
No, so I think working with family can be some of the most challenging kinds of experiences because you have so many levels of interaction, so many different roles that you're playing. Are you playing the role of daughter, of partner, and so on? So piece number one, advice number one would be to clarify what role is each of you playing at different points in time? So as you're making the corporate decisions, are you playing the role as partners? Or is this the father-daughter relationship at that point in time? That's one way things get confused. So you can clarify that. Second is another one of the lures, these emotional forces that I talk about in the book. It's something that Sigmund Freud originally called attention to. He called it the repetition compulsion. Mm-hmm. And this is the idea that all of us, not just you and your father, but all of us tend to repeat the same dysfunctional patterns of behavior again and again and again and again, even if it's self-sabotaging to family relations, to corporate interest. And so one piece of advice that you might consider would be before you next meet with your father, to think through what is the typical pattern of conflict that you get into, even if it's the pattern of conflict about how to talk about dealing with your conflicts. You know, what's that pattern? Do you open the conversation in a collaborative way and then he defends and you defend? Do you both withdraw very quickly? Do you both collaborate with a smile on your face but there's emotional distance? What is the pattern that is there? And what is then one behavior that you might try differently? Hmm. You know, if typically you react within 2 minutes defensively to your father, maybe it might be trying to take the extra minute, even if it might not feel comfortable, and appreciate where he's coming from. You know what, Dad? I understand why you think, you know, it's important to approach this with a cold corporate eye. You know, help me understand more about what your thinking is there and how we could do that.
Right.
I'm not saying I agree with you, Dad, but I really want to understand.
Yeah. It's interesting to go through the exercise, the active exercise of putting yourself in the shoes of the other person who's sitting across the table from you. That seems to go a long way to achieving some of the goals that you were just talking about, Dan. But if I can just switch gears a little bit here, I did want to talk about another one of the five lures of the tribal mind that you write about in the book, and that is assault on the sacred, because that's the one that I felt was most challenging.
Yeah.
And it gets to the title of your book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, because that's where it seems like a lot of people do have certain things that they believe they hold sacred, and they will not negotiate over them. How do you manage that?
Well, first of all, it's extremely difficult. And some could argue, and in some ways rightly, that it's impossible. Because what is sacred, by definition, holds infinite value. And how can you ever negotiate something that holds infinite value? At the same time, there are ways to negotiate what is typically conceived of as sacred. Piece number one, better understand, it's back to awareness, better understand what that other side holds as sacred and really step into their shoes. Why is it that they want to continue to have the menorah or the Hanukkah, the Christmas tree in the home, and they hold on to that and they say, this is sacred, this is sacred, this is sacred to me. Mm. What's beneath that? Is it religious element that's beneath it? What elements of religion make you want to have that in our household? Is it the fact that you want to hold loyalty to your legacy, your parents, your grandparents who raised you in a particular way? What makes this sacred? And that realization alone often opens up doors for collaborative possibility.
So how does that work on a much bigger scale? I mean, you've been around the world talking people through negotiations that have to do with, you know, you mentioned Israel and Palestine, lots of other seemingly intractable conflicts. Mm. I mean, I'd love an example from your own personal experience and how you got around this question of what is sacred.
Yeah, well, two things. One, it's not a quick fix. You know, this book is not the quick fix. If that's what somebody's looking for, this is a real fix. How do you shift the nature of the relationship when there's emotional tension and charge? Example, and this connects with another one of the Lord's taboos. Mm-hmm. So in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, a number of years back, I had organized a small group of Israeli, Palestinian, international leadership focused on dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Tony Blair was there and others. The question we were asking there was, how do you deal with taboo issues? Issues that are just dead center at the heart of that conflict. And yet everybody is scared to death to talk about those issues. How do you negotiate, for example, as some of them said to me, when some on one side won't call the other, you're not Israelis, mm-hmm, or Palestinians, for fear of legitimizing the cause of the other. How do you negotiate when it's taboo to call the other by their name? And I'm not arguing whether they're right or wrong. I'm just saying, practically speaking, to your question,
right,
how do you negotiate? And so what we did was we created this brave space, this space that was out of the media's attention. It was unofficial. And we had them in small groups think through what are some of the key taboos that are holding back movement toward peace. And in these small mixed groups, they asked the question, well, what are the benefits of this taboo? What are the downfalls of holding on to this taboo? What are the benefits of breaking the taboo? What are the downfalls of breaking the taboo?
Yeah.
And they walk away with a much better understanding of what is impeding the process toward dealing with sacred.
So I can see the power in going through that exercise of identifying, mm-hmm, these taboos. But it occurs to me that it requires even the willingness to have that conversation. It requires, mm-hmm, at least some modicum of ability or desire of each party to show some empathy for the other. And I'm wondering, so given that, like, how far can your techniques or the techniques that you write about in the book really be taken? I'm wondering, okay, now I'm not saying, I'm going to throw out a hypothetical here, and I'm not saying it's likely or even advisable, but say, you know, a U.S. leader were sitting across the table from a leader in ISIS.
Yes.
How can that conversation happen when it seems as if, you know, the Islamic State has one goal and one goal only, which would be, you know, the creation of its caliphate and the destruction of whoever it considers infidels, that there's no room for empathy there.
Right. Well, I mean, it goes back to this notion of the tribes effect. It's us versus them. We, and by the way, I think that ISIS is completely reprehensible, so I'm not an advocate here for their ways. But we do fall trapped to that, and I think they fall trapped to that as well, that all of a sudden it's us versus them, me versus you in the situation, when there are undoubtedly many more interests at play from ISIS's perspective. You know, the 14-year-old isn't necessarily going to join ISIS for a huge spiritual, ideological reason. That may be that, but it may be more that there's a social set of forces pulling them to move toward joining ISIS. So I would not recommend that a top-level state official from the United States goes to meet with a top-level official from ISIS and they negotiate. I think that's conferring much too much legitimacy on ISIS. On the other hand, I think it could be extremely useful for third or fourth tier people, perhaps connected with the government informally in some sort of way, to be meeting in some place, some way, with some of the people involved in ISIS to better understand what's your mindset. Hmm. What do you really want to accomplish? What do your leaders want to accomplish? Because the more we can understand what they hold as sacred and what they hold as quasi-sacred, you know, they say it's sacred, but, well, this is just so I can stay in power and get on the cover of the New York Times again. This is pretty cool. You know, what's really sacred? What's quasi-sacred? What's motivating them? Hmm. The more I can understand that, the more we, the United States, the more the government can effectively influence policy and practice of ISIS, trying to eradicate the system. Hmm.
It's so interesting to talk with you because we can have I can ask you these questions on the level of global negotiations, but also I want to bring it back down to the level where most of us might actually find ourselves in a negotiation and could always use some help. Hmm. How do some of the lessons that you talk about in the book apply to, say, a salary negotiation?
Well, I think these can be emotionally charged situations.
Very.
And I'd go back to the repetition compulsion again. When you walk into a tense negotiation, what's your typical way of dealing with that? And for most of us in a negotiation, it's anxiety, it's fear, and we often become our own worst critic in terms of negotiation. I want the raise, but you don't have to give it to me. I've only been here for 2 years, and I only have, 15 degrees. So I'd start, before you even walk into that negotiation, by thinking through what is your typical negotiation pattern, and how can you make that a more powerful pattern? If you find yourself withdrawing or conceding too quickly, don't do it. Point number two, what do things look like from that boss's perspective? Why in the world should this boss be giving you a raise? And what are the 23 reasons that this boss is likely to say no? Mm-hmm. The boss has his or her own challenges. Where are they going to get the money from? Maybe they love you. They want to give you a raise. But things are tight right now within the organization. It's useful to think through what do things look like from the boss's perspective? What are their constraints? And why should they say yes?
So two good pointers there. Everyone listening, take them to heart. Dan, we've just got a minute left, literally, and I did want to ask you one final question, and that is, we have been talking about emotions in the context of this conversation as something which frequently trip people up in negotiations. Is there anything about the fact that we are emotional creatures that actually can be strengths when it comes to negotiations?
Amen, hallelujah, yes. I am not at all saying get rid of emotions. Just the opposite. And this book is a point, in fact, how do you bring useful emotions, positive emotions into the negotiation? Whether it's you and your spouse or the two of us here in this wonderful conversation.
It can be done.
Yes.
Well, there's so much more detail, pointers, and analysis in the new book. I suggest that everybody read it. It's Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Dan Shapiro, founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program, thank you so very much for coming in and having this conversation with me.
Thank you. It's an honor. Thank you.
It's an honor for us as well. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.